So this is a talk about various sort of operational studies at the CBeta four-turn ERL, which has an FFA return loop for four different energies. We're going to concentrate on some things that we did during operations of the machine and things that you have to look out for if you're going to operate a machine. So the overall layout of this machine is that it's a four-turn energy recovery LINAC. There's a fixed field arc which puts all four energies back into the LINAC, but in between the arc and the LINAC there are these splitters, which every energy gets different adjustments for time of flight and for optical matching to the LINAC and other things. This allows you to sort of control the longitudinal phase space as it goes into the LINAC so that it decelerates properly. In ERLs, you generally do need this sort of tunability, particularly multi-turn ERLs, so that you can... You can make it through all the turns because it's just a transfer line, so you don't want errors to build up. You have to make sure everything's matched nicely. The optics of that return loop, the red, yellow, green, and blue in the top diagram are the four different beam energies from 42 up to 150 MeV that go through that loop, with the black being the sort of central reference line. And there's two magnets per cell. And the graphs over at the right show that the orbits in the arc are separated, but they merge into parallel coincident orbits in the straight section as the curvature is reduced. That's one of the slightly unusual features of CBeta. So here is an animation of how those four different energy beams go through the arc cells, with the greenish one being 42 MeV over at the right, and the reddish one, purple one, in fact, at the left being the 150 MeV beam. And you see they're all matched, but they've got different orbit positions and different beta functions. The magnets we used to get to produce this fixed field, we have the permanent magnets because the field's not changing. And they're based on a variant of the Halbach design. So here's just a picture of those permanent magnet pieces sitting in an aluminium enclosure. And the rotating coil is the brown thing going through the middle of it. Around the edge outside, there is a electromagnetic window frame corrector, which gives you up to 5 or 10% of the main field so that you can make fine corrections to the steering of the beam, because of course the placement of these magnets will not be perfect first time. So you use that electromagnetic coil around the outside. The field propagates inside because the permanent magnets are transparent. They aren't iron, so they have mu equals one. So you can adjust the dipole component on each of these magnets. And when they're all installed, this is what one side of the arc looks like. The hoses are the water cooling, and you mainly see the electromagnetic corrects around the outside. It's kind of difficult to see the permanent magnets in the center. This bit does show you something of the curvature change as you go into the second arc. Now, one thing that people ask about, especially when you're talking about an ERL, when you're going to go to higher beam current and higher power, is do you have halo in your machine? And the simplest way you can think of measuring this is to increase the exposure of the diagnostics that look at beam screens. So initially you get a spot on your beam screen and you'll reduce the exposure until you are not saturated in the middle, but then you can increase the exposure so the middle becomes saturated but the outside starts to light up. And that's what this picture is here. There's an elliptical kind of, you can see in blue the elliptical beam screen. And the other contours are a kind of log color scale of intensity of the beam distribution. And what we found with this is that we have some sort of halo even quite early on in the machine. This is after the injector. So as well as beam core, it's something around 3 × 10⁻⁴ relative intensity per unit area. There is a kind of knee in the distribution. So we reckon we have some halo which comes from the source. Remembering that halo can come from like six different possible sources of halo. But this is the halo that comes from possibly stray light hitting the photocathode at the beginning of the machine. And because the area of that blob at 3 × 10⁻⁴ intensity is actually quite large compared to the beam core, we reckon 3% of the charge was in this halo. So if you get an image like that, you have to make sure that it really is halo and it's not, stray light on the camera or kind of a lens flare. So we varied a quadrupole just upstream of that image, and this animation shows that the halo really does change shape So it must be made of charged particles, namely electrons in this case. The core also changes shape a bit. So you can try and, another operation thing you might want to do is make sure your beam's going through the center of the quadrupoles. So if the beam isn't centered in the quadrupole, and you change the quadrupole strength, the beam position will change downstream of that, and you can measure that in the beam position monitor. By looking at the change you get, you can then figure out how to change another dipole upstream of the quad to steer the beam into the middle of the quadrupole, so that when that quadrupole's change, it doesn't change in the downstream BPM. So it's possible to center the beam through quadrupoles in such a way that the quadrupoles don't affect the steering. Now, this animation demonstrates a test of this. So we made sure that we were centered in quadrupoles, and then we went a long way downstream of the quadrupole. In fact, this isn't so far downstream, but here it's downstream of the quadrupole. We're changing it, and what we're demonstrating is that we change it, part of the beam still remains on the screen, even though its shape changes. The center doesn't move. It's just the beam shape. And then here we've gone a long way downstream. So this is actually in the return splitter. But it's still true that the center, or one particle in the middle of the beam distribution, stays on the screen as the quadrupole has changed, because this particle is going through the zero of the quadrupole. And so no matter how far you propagate the beam, there's still that one particle that stays pinned in place. And this is useful for commissioning, because it means you don't lose your beam off the side of the screen, at which point you're lost. So this allows you to at least keep some of the beam on the screen, and then hopefully optimize the focusing so that more of it's on the screen. Again, here's another downstream plot in the return splitter as a quadrupole upstream is varied. And again, despite aberrations having occurred by this point, it's the beam center still stays on the screen. Now, the other thing you can do is you can try and use the quadrupoles themselves as beam position monitors, because of course the beam position of the quadrupole affects how much the orbit responds. So a tool was made that varies these quads and then tries to estimate the beam position in the quads. And then you can combine that in a graph with the beam position measurements from the BPMs and the screens that are insertable. And so we got a combined plots on the bottom. So we can go up from sort of having 4 or 5 points in one of the splitter lines to having about 13 points in this diagnostic sort of orbit positions being read out from the splitters, which we thought would help in commissioning, just so that we can get a better idea of what the orbit is, and we can cross calibrate between these different, or at least cross check between these different ways of measuring the beam position. Now, when I talked about these orbit correctors, the electromagnetic correctors around the permanent magnets, you can use an SVD type optimizer to try and get the orbit to the target values. Effectively, you have a linear model. There's a linear response to the correctors of the orbit, and the result of using that SVD process is shown at the bottom. Meanwhile, the initial orbit with no correction, but just some crude beam threading, is shown on the top. So at the top, it's all over the place and oscillating by centimeter, because we have no, you know, the correction wasn't really in at that point. But then when you use the SVD, you get this very nice plot at the bottom with less than 1 millimeter orbit errors. Now, I said that you had to construct a linear response to the correctors, and we have a lot of cells in the FFA. So the modeled response matrix from the vertical machine, the simulation we have online, those response matrices look like the things at the bottom of the screen. So you see one half of the matrix is empty, because that's the response of BPMs before the corrector. So by causality, there shouldn't be any response there. And then the response afterwards is regular ripples, because each corrector produces an orbit oscillation started at a different cell. But the cells are relatively uniform, so it all looks like diagonal lines, because wherever you start the orbit ripple, it looks the same, it's just shifted. So we have that model of the response to a corrector in the FFA, but then you could also measure the real response by setting off a corrector at the beginning of the FFA, and you'll get a wiggle as well. They look very similar if you don't plot them superimposed, but if if you look at, so the original, the bumps we measured were on the top plot to a 90 degree out of phase bumps. But if you compare one of the bumps to the simulated bump, which is the bottom graph, then you find that they go in and out of phase, so that they start out of phase in the arc, then they go into phase in the straight, and they come out of phase in the arc again. So if you try and correct using this simulated thing, it won't work because the phases are completely wrong by the end of the machine. So the question is, what do you do about that? And here's a plot of the cumulative phase difference between the virtual machine simulation and the measured data. As you see, the number of cycles it was wrong by is about 0.6 by the end of the line. So this means that you can't use the correction long range with this model. So how do you fix the model? So you want to construct a semi-empirical response matrix, which has basically the optics from the virtual machine, but you replace the phase advances by experimentally measured phase advances. So I have this function called make oval, which encodes the phase space ellipse shape, but the phase advances are taken from actual data. And you also need to have a phase advance valued between the corrector and the BPM, because they're not actually on top of each other. So there is there's a sort of recipe for making this response matrix. And with this response matrix, you can apply a single matrix to the entire FFA loop and get this very nice correction. The one I showed on the previous slide that looked like this was, it used the correction in sections, so it never did a long range SVD. So I had a little matrix for every 20 cells or so. This one uses the 107 by 107 matrix, which with the semi-empirical phases. This demonstrates that this method works. Now, the other way you could have tried doing this is actually measure not just semi-empirical, but fully empirical response matrices, where you try and get the whole 107 by 107 matrix from the machine by doing 107 bumps. And Kirsten Dietrich did this on one shift out of interest. And there is some good reasons for wanting to do this, because if you have any hardware errors, they will show up as faulty rows or columns in the pattern, because, you know, if your BPMs are wired backwards, which can happen, or there's a bad connection, you'll get a row that looks wrong. If you've got a corrector which is powered, the leads are interchanged, or it's not powered, or there's a ground fault, it will make a column look wrong. So when you actually get the fully empirical response matrix, it looks like this as a first attempt. So we have something like 3 or 4 obvious wrong columns and 4 incorrect rows. So this allowed us to debug our machine. So this is a nice thing to do because it allows you to automatically debug your machine and find faults, although it's a bit time consuming for normal use. And there's 2 sections here because you have both the X and the Y plane matrices stacked together. So X should only affect X and Y should only affect Y, more or less. That we find that there is a slight change in the phase advance in the FFA from day to day whenever we set up the machine at CBT, because it turned off overnight. That was our main problem in when we would come back the next day, the SVD correction wouldn't work so well. So we created a program to measure the tunes each day and then construct a new matrix each time. And it was sufficient to have a flat tuner for each section of the machine in this case. It didn't even need to be every cell. I seem to have gone to the end. So here's the get all tunes script, which will get a tune for every section of the machine, as well as an average tune for the entire loop, using a kind of a Fourier transform to find where the peak of the frequency spectrum is from a bump that it automatically produces. So this is a useful tool to have. Now, C-beta has 4 turns, in fact, 4 up and then 4 down. Only the 4 upgoing turns are shown in this diagram, but the response matrix to correctors becomes quite complicated when you have multiple turns. The splitters will set off bumps for the turn to which they apply, because there's 4 parallel lines, 1 for each turn. That's the first 4 rows here. But the FFA correctors will actually produce a bump in every time the beam goes through, which means that your response going through multiple turns is very messy, because a wiggle is formed, and then it wraps around through the linac and splitters again and starts in the second turn, and then it gets hit by the same character again and it changes in amplitude and phase. And so this would be very complicated if we did it this way. Instead, we have to find a way of decoupling the turns. So these boxes with R in are the return splitter, in which we have constructed an algorithm to essentially, we use the SBD in the return lines to force the beam center back to its original position in the return line, so that any changes you make in one turn of the FFA does not affect after the return line, and therefore doesn't affect through the linac, through the split next splitter, and the beam starts in the same position in the next turn. So you have to have a decoupling system when you make changes in the FFA, so that those changes don't propagate around to the next turn, because the interactions become quite nightmarish that way. So once you've got two turns and you've got your turns decoupled by that algorithm, which runs after each SVD iteration, you now need the response matrix for two turns, which is shown here. You have both the X and Y planes, and now you have BPMs. Well, it's the same BPM, but the BPM can get different signals from each turn via timing. So effectively you have a different BPM reading for each turn, and that's why there's more rows in this matrix now. So turn two gets its own set of rows, so that turn can be independently diagnosed. Here are two turns without correction. They just threaded the second turn through. Now, the correction on the first turn brought our magnets closer to where they should be, so the second turn went through fairly easily. But then after correction, the second turn is very smooth, almost as smooth as the first turn. So it's possible to use SVD on multiple turns simultaneously, even when they share correctors, as long as you're careful with decoupling and things like that. And we continued in this way and got the SVD working on the first three turns. The fourth turn turns out that the magnets were sufficiently close that it went through anyway. So at this point, we were more interested in transmission issues through the decelerating turns. So this is the best we did with multi-turn and SVD, and the orbit errors are less than about 2 millimeters in this case. And there's also decelerating turns in here. So really, those ones with the black squares have gone down the machine as well. So this is really quite a complicated optics that's been successfully run here. From all these turns, you can get the tunes and compare them to the model, which is the line, and the experimentally measured tunes are the dots. There's a bit of a glitch in one of them, but our tunes, generally speaking, lie on the line where we expect them to do, which is good. You can also check another tool we made. We may want to check the accelerating and decelerating turns, which share the same splitter line in lines 1, 2, and 3, because it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2, 1. You can make a tool to ensure that the orbit of the accelerating and decelerating turns are similar, and this is what is shown here, and this is a live tool that we use during tuning up of the decelerating turns. A very important thing about the splitter lines is they're supposed to change the time of flight. The FFA return loop is a non-scaling FFA, so it has a parabolic dependence of path length and time of flight on energy. So that needs to be removed if you want the energy recovery to be always on crest, both accelerating and decelerating. So you need to be able to change the path length and the splitter. Now, we had motorized sliding joints, some of which seized up, which could change the path length in a kind of macroscopic way, but they weren't very smooth to use. But then we got a mystery path length problem that seemed to change when we retuned the splitter. And it turned out that the beam was going off center through large angle bends. Some of the bends in the splitter are up to 40 degrees or more. And so when you go off, if you're a few millimeters to the side in that bend, you actually just get a longer path length simply from delta x times theta, simply from being outside or inside of a bend. So it turns out that in a wiggling splitter line that goes left, right, left, left, right, left, there's a recipe for pushing the beam into the outside or the inside of each of those curves, which has a very significant effect on path length. Because as we first set up the machine, The beam was basically taking a shortcut. It was cutting every corner, and we couldn't understand why our beam was a centimeter shorter than it should be. The path of the beam was arriving too early. So by pushing the beam out in each of those corners, we managed to fix that, and it gives a very big, you know, tens of degrees of RF phase tunability, which is exactly what you want. And it allowed us to get all the RF phases on target in the energy recovery. Another operational problem we had was that the magnets in the splitter, which have iron poles, they have a hysteresis. The iron becomes magnetized. And so when you try and go back to the same setting, you don't get the same field. And we had no way to detect this other than looking at what the beam did after the magnet, at least in our first run. So all these bar charts are basically, I varied an iron magnet to its maximum, brought it back to a nominal value, and then logged where the beam was after it. Then I brought the dipole to its minimum value and back to its nominal value, and then looked at where the beam was after that process. And the beam can sometimes be 3 or 4 millimeters different, depending on whether you've gone up and down to the current or down and up to the current. So that's the blue bars in these plots. The orange bars are how much of a difference I got after a degaussing process where the magnet was oscillated up and down in current to try and remove this memory, this hysteresis effect. And so by choosing different settings of this going up and down square wave, you had varying degrees of success in getting rid of the hysteresis effect. Eventually, we tried actually just making the degaussing waveform as big as it could be, in other words, going to the limits of the power supply. And this actually made our procedure even better. But even with that procedure, there were still residual changes, which meant if you tried to reload the machine settings, even with the full range degaussing, you still didn't thread the beam through the LINAC, which was the difficult part, because the LINAC is a very long section with no focusing. So the angles have to be very precise to go in there. And it turned out that we couldn't reload our machine settings and get through the LINAC. So we ended up spending many hours each day retuning the machine, which wasn't ideal. Another operational thing we tried was to make closed bumps in the FFA. So rather than correcting things in the recombiner to decouple the terms, you could try and construct bumps sort of algebraically that are intrinsically closed. So with a single turn, that's a 3-corrector bump. You bump it out and then bump it back and then you straighten it out. If you have 2 turns, you need a 5-corrector bump, and we produced a function which, given the tunes of the 2 different turns, solved the matrix system to tell you what those 5 correctors would be. And this continues. In theory, a 3-turn would require 7 correctors, and all 4 turns to be closed on all 4 turns, you'd require 9 correctors. As it turned out, with multiple turns, this became increasingly sensitive and would require a lot of fine tuning to really work well. So all we ended up doing was using the single turn bumps to turn the plot of the beam position in each cell into a smiley face. So that at least demonstrates that we have a good handle on correcting each individual part of the machine locally. So as I've alluded to before, there are some things that we want to improve in operationally. One is there, we were often loose in time because the superconducting RF would trip. And also it seemed the cavity voltages would drift, even though the sensor was telling us, the sensor it was feeding back on was telling us the amplitude was the same, the energy would still drift because we saw the beam changing angle through dipoles. I think these things are somewhat standard for superconducting RF because it's a difficult thing to set up. The things that we really think we can address, well, the machine settings not being reloadable, that was to do with the hysteresis in the iron magnets, mainly in the splitter that I mentioned before. The tuning in the splitter got very difficult when we had multiple turns, because the stray field from the magnets in one turn would affect the position in the previous turn, which would then cause a orbit error that would come round to the turn you're trying to correct. So tuning one line would affect past lines, which made it very difficult to actually tune it well. So that's another thing that could possibly be improved. To see what the problem is with the crosstalk, here's a photograph of the splitter while it was under construction. And these magnets are sort of, you know, if they were any closer together, they'd be inside each other. So this is why there's the possibility of stray fields. Most of the magnets have a closed design, like an H-dipole or a quadrupole, but there's a few correctors in there that have an open top, and those seem to be particular troublemakers, although we need to investigate more to make sure that, you know, we haven't got other sources of stray field. So the possible remedies, Dejan Trobojevic has suggested that we could totally replace the splitter by a line that still has all four the energies in the same place. The optics of that are extremely tricky because you're now trying to correct four beams with the same correctors. In principle, the optical match is possible. I'm not sure if the time of flight match would be possible, is all I have to say about that. But I think Dejan's talking more about that in his own talk. You could replace the iron pole magnets by Halbach magnets that rotate so as to tune the total field. Now, that's expensive, unfortunately, and disruptive to the machine. It does completely get rid of any iron hysteresis. It would only replace it by mechanical backlash, which can actually be made rather small. So that would probably give much more reliable and repeatable fields. So there's some, and another reason to do this is the Halbach magnets have fairly small fringe fields, generally speaking, because they're all sort of, all the currents are basically in a loop. The virtual currents produced by the permanent magnets are all small loops. So they tend to have short fringe fields anyway. So that's one option. The option I like the best at the moment is installing Hall probes in the magnets and possibly even in the drift spaces to use as a feedback, just as a log of whether our real field is back to where it was. And then you use those to set the magnets. And that should try and compensate for any hysteresis effects. And if you're really lucky, they might even detect some of the field crosstalk, and you could try and either observe that or compensate for that, or at least bring the machine back to repeatable settings. So that is all of my talk. Okay.